Hello. This is the podcast for our class number 11 on October 4, and we started a whole new section tonight dealing, but still in the same related topic of special duty rules. But now our duty inquiry has turned to, again, limitations on liability. And the topic is governmental immunities, limitations on liability because of the question of governmental immunity. And when we're talking about governmental immunity, always look at your defendant. Is it going to be, are there questions about this particular defendant that immediately raises a red flag to you? And if we're talking about a governmental immunity, it should. If you're looking at the defendant and it's a government, it's an individual working for the government, an agency, you should automatically be thinking in terms of duty. Now, sometimes immunities are a question of defenses, but I think in this situation, you should be looking at it primarily as a duty question. So, when we talk about issues with governmental entities, then you have to remember that you start from a position of immunity to lawsuit, no potential for lawsuit because the historical background of sovereign immunity. It's the government who makes the rules can't be held to break the rules. Sovereign immunity has been eliminated in all jurisdictions, either by statute by statute primarily. But it doesn't mean that there's an open door to suing all government entities. You still have to jump through certain number of hoops in order to be able to reach the government entities. Why? Because the courts have, even though sovereign immunity is no longer the driving power, separation of powers is the main concern for our courts. So they're not going, the big thing you have to consider is whether this is holding a duty of care or responsibility would be stepping on, impinging upon the government's role as a government entity. So your first question always is whatever caused the injury or harm, was it the government acting in its governmental capacity, or was it acting in a proprietary capacity? Remember we said the Staten Island Ferry, although it's run by the New York Transit Authority, which is the city of New York, Staten Island Ferry is just a transportation. It's proprietary. Same way running hospitals, proprietary. So it's not an inherent governmental function to run a transportation system. And so that's a proprietary matter, and they're held to regular reasonable care standards. So if you're looking at the duty first, is it proprietary or governmental? If it's governmental, we have other questions to answer, but that's our threshold question. So, again, proprietary or governmental, answer that question. If it's governmental, then we have to move to see what exactly, again, caused the harm. If it's a governmental action, is it the government acting in a policy role, or is it just the government merely carrying out policy that's already been decided on? Again, making policy is something the courts don't want to have to do. But once policy has been made, they have to do it reasonably. So you can see that the questions that the courts are looking for are ones that don't want to interfere with the discretionary powers of government, but if it's merely ministerial or operation carrying out discretionary policies that have already been set, then the courts are more willing to, have opened themselves to be willing to look at the reasonableness of their operations. So we looked at the risk case first, and this case provides an example of the effort that our plaintiff was making to hold the police department of the city of New York responsible for her ultimate injury, her physical injury by the hand of a third party. And we talked about this a lot. When is somebody going to be responsible for the physical injury that happens by a third party? We talked about it with Tarasoff. We talked about it with Randy V. Murak. Remember the school district? We talked about it with Reynolds v. Hicks. Responsibility for injuries from a third party. And we said a lot of it relied upon foreseeability. Is it was it foreseeable and that something was going to happen? And did they have the opportunity to control it? Did they have the power to control it? So control and knowledge that if you didn't exercise that power to control, that it was likely to have dire consequences. We saw in landlord-tenant, again, the foreseeability of the crime in the area and the power to make the area safe was what gave a duty to a landlord or the property owner or occupier to have a duty against to make secure against criminal actions. Here, it's a different inquiry, and it's really interesting that it gives an example of how much you would, how much the court doesn't want to deal with these governmental entities that supposedly the duty of the police department is to make things safe, security. But here they didn't promise risk that they would help her. They said, in fact, they wouldn't help her. And the court says because there was no direct promise to risk to help her, there was no assumption of a duty. So there was a duty to all but not to one. She had no reason to rely upon them. If she truly felt unsafe, she should have made efforts on her own. But the court did not assume a duty. Now, this gets a lot into our nonfeasance, misfeasance notions, but the overarching, and the court says here, the city of New York would be overwhelmed, it would be open the floodgates, it would be a crushing burden. It comes right down to the unwillingness of the courts to interfere with these fundamental governmental decisions. The court's not going to take over running a police department. They're not going to question whether the police department is running well in the decisions that they make. That's not what the court's going to do. It's not what they do best. Question that with Sorchetti. Question that with, compare that with Schuster. Schuster, they had the, remember it was the individual who had provided information. Court never said they were going to, the police never said they were going to protect them, but by cooperating with the police, it put them in danger. And by doing that, the police actually, put them into the risk. And so the court said, the court said that. Because the police had created the risk themselves, really, they had a duty towards this individual. Sorchetti, duty based on the police had issued a protective order. And the court said, because of the protective order, our plaintiff had a justifiable reliance on police protection. They couldn't police couldn't turn around and say, well, we didn't promise directly. The protective order was kind of a promise. At least it created a justifiable reliance and an expectation. So under very narrow circumstances, and definitely Shuster and Sorchetti are narrow circumstances, the court was willing to say, you know, that it was more of a misfeasance, that they should, you know, again, that there was a duty. And once there's a duty, they have to, the inquiry is, did they behave reasonably or not? You know, duty, opening the duty just opens the door to the second aspect of our behavior, the second aspect of our inquiry. But contrast this with Cuffy. Again, we're always talking about promises to protect, promises or failure to protect. And Cuffy is sort of the outline region of these cases, these failure to protect cases. In Cuffy, the court, even though they had made promises, the court laid down very strict requirements for a liability. And you've got to know that these requirements are quite strict for liability in these protection cases. Now, again, it's protection against criminal activity. Make a distinction. Don't throw Cuffy up into ordinary proprietary matters. Of course, that's not what's happening. It's protection against criminal activity. So Cuffy doesn't always apply, but promises to protect by the police, you know, require a special relationship. So Cuffy, that showed the four factors and how seriously the court considers those. We move to Lauer, which is, again, the outside of our protection. And it wasn't a promise to protect. Lauer is a different sort of case. It wasn't an operational versus discretionary function, as were Cuffy, Sorchetti, Shuster, Riss. Here, our medical examiner was definitely acting in a ministerial capacity, an operational capacity. He was doing his job as a medical examiner. And if it had only been that he did a poor job, perhaps there wouldn't have been any question about his duty here. Can you sue just because somebody's doing a poor job? Probably not, even though it created a great hardship for our plaintiff. But he did a poor job, and the poor job put the plaintiff in jeopardy for 17 months. He did it. Our medical examiner discovered that he had made a big mistake in the autopsy and yet didn't remedy it until he was basically outed in a newspaper article. Meanwhile, our plaintiff had, you know, definitely suffered to a great degree by undergoing criminal investigation. Why not sue the police? There's no indication that they did anything wrong. They were acting in their police capacity and on valid concerns. So they, you know, were acting on a medical report said that the child's death was caused by a homicide. So there's no liability at all on the police. What we're dealing with here, though, the court says, well, there's no responsibility to individuals in the medical examiner's job. And we sort of saw this before. When is there a responsibility to an individual who's been injured on the part of some sort of a school or an agency or whatever? When's there a responsibility? We've seen this before. We saw it in our Randy v. Murdoch case. I'm sorry. It wasn't Randy. We saw it in the case. They were trying to have a duty, trying to impose a duty of care based on the violation of a statute. Here, the court looks and says, well, is there a duty, is there a private right of action, a duty to individuals based on the statute? And they said, no, statute said you have to go to the medical examiner only reports to the DA. Well, is there any common law duty to individuals? And the court said no, and there would have to be a special relationship, and there was no special relationship. And this is a special relationship, not as we saw under an affirmative duty to act, like we saw at the very start of this duty inquiry. The special relationship is more based on the special relationship that they talked about in RIS and talked about in Cuffey, that there was direct contact, and there was no direct contact between the medical examiner and our plaintiff in order to establish a duty between the two. Lauer is pretty far out in terms of our inquiry here, pretty far out. So I left you with the hypothetical of the random vehicle stop set up by the police. Erica comes along, gets stopped. She's driving while drunk. The police officer at the vehicle stop says, "You're too drunk to drive. Go home immediately." She takes off and runs over Tad. What's the liability of the police? How do you analyze this? Is it more like setting up a stoplight where it's be discretionary to have it, but once you have it, it's operational and it has to run properly, like 911, or does Erica need some sort of special relation? I mean, does Tad need some sort of special relationship, a la Lauer, to hold the police responsible for his injuries? And that's how you should analyze it. I don't exactly know what the answer would be, but the analysis should be to compare it. Was the decision here operational, or was it discretionary? Even if it was operational, would it require a special relationship? Okay, so next class we're going to start with our short quiz, 20 minutes, and then we'll move on to Friedman.